I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As the Republicans get ready for their final debate before the Iowa caucuses on February 1st, this hour we are going to be talking about Donald Trump, the demagogue. Our guest this hour writes in a recent piece that Trump possesses an arrogance and volatility that makes most voters recoil. So how has he maintained a grip on a segment of the Republican base that at least for now seems unshakable? And how has his support persisted despite the fact that some have called him a demagogue and a fascist, or that political observers have found parallels between him and polarizing figures like George Wallace, Joseph McCarthy, Father Coughlin, and even Hitler? This hour of the program, we will talk about that with our guest who was quoted in the New York Times and wrote a piece for The Conversation. She joins us from Texas A&M University, where she's Associate Professor of Communication. Jennifer Mercia is with us. Jennifer is a historian of American political discourse, and she writes about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She argues that the current views of citizenship rely on the tragic and ironic views which don't enable citizens to act to control their government. Her presidency research is extensive. She is the author of Founding Fictions, the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's written a number of essays as well. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Professor Mercia. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Mercia, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. The problem, you know, you read more of these reports day by day. The more that Donald Trump speaks, we have all of these actions, anti-Muslim actions taking place all over the country. We have horrendous incidents taking place at Donald Trump rallies. You know, it's nothing that's very humorous anymore. It's become quite serious, and it seems to me rather dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a report yesterday about his rally in Las Vegas that seems to have gotten out of control, with people making threats, saying things that Nazis said.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's time to worry.
Yeah. So a lot of people have called him a demagogue. Tell me what that word means and how it is applicable to Donald Trump.
Yeah, so in the literal Greek sense of the term demagogue, a demagogue is a leader of the people. And there's no reason why we should think of a leader of the people as a misleader of the people. But unfortunately, the way that we use the word demagogue in modern political discourse is to think of someone who is an uncontrollable leader, someone who is ambitious to a fault, meaning that they are trying to seek office for their own personal gain rather than for the common good, and someone who uses duplicitous or divisive rhetorical appeals in order to gain power.
Mm-hmm. He uses all of these different strategies, which you outline in your very interesting piece. And let's start with this appealing to voters' fears by depicting a nation in crisis. It would appear that the nation is in a bit of a crisis right now. And then he's the hero who's going to save everybody, except he doesn't have a lot of heroic credentials, does he?
That's exactly right. And it's a common strategy for presidential candidates to depict a nation in crisis. And so if you look at current presidential candidates, for Bernie Sanders, the crisis is income inequality. For Ted Cruz, it's something about the Constitution and foreign policy. For Marco Rubio, it is the American dream is in crisis, right? So each presidential candidate is going to try to frame the nation in a certain way, and they're going to try to insert themselves in the story of the nation as being the one qualified to save the nation from crisis. So Donald Trump is not unusual in doing that. Where he is unusual, I think, although maybe there's just degrees of this in this year's field, but where he is unusual is that he is setting the crisis up as one where we are beset on all sides. There are enemies within, there are enemies without. We must throw up walls and protect our borders, right? So it's a very isolationist, scary, right? We've been infiltrated kind of rhetoric that I think is different from some of the other candidates.
Mm-hmm. He, you write, urges his audiences to trust him. He promises them he is really smart. He flexes his prophetic muscles. And he seems to do a lot of this by just saying how smart he is. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? He doesn't, you know, I'm smart, they're weak, I'm really smart, I'm really smart, I made a lot of money. There's not a whole lot of depth to his intelligence.
That's right. Well, I don't know if there is depth to his intelligence, but there certainly isn't depth to his appeal, right? That his argument that he's very smart. I watched two of his campaign rallies from beginning to end from a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, so that's 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first half of each rally, he just sort of repeated a kind of stream of consciousness thing about how smart he is and how successful he is. And how well he's doing in the polls, and how other people are dummies. There didn't seem to be any sort of line of argument. It was just sort of, I'm really smart. I'm really, really smart. I'm so smart.
Mm-hmm. And yet you say that being self-congratulatory like that is the epitome of hubris, which is often the least attractive quality of a potential leader. So why do a lot of people see it as attractive?
Yeah, well, so it's an interesting conundrum, I think, for those of us who study American politics and political history. So normally, Americans desire a candidate who fits the mold of Cincinnatus. So Cincinnatus, for your readers or listeners who don't remember, is the Roman statesman who left office and retired to his farm, and then Rome was under siege, and they appealed to him to save the city, and he was, you know, at the plow. And he said, no, no, I cannot. I'm, you know, harvesting. And they said, no, you must. And so he puts down the plow, right, and he goes and he saves Rome. And then instead of becoming dictator, which would be owed to him, he instead gives up the sword of power. So in the United States political culture, George Washington is America's Cincinnatus.
Mm.
He absolutely was cognizant of Cincinnatus, the Society of Cincinnati he was president of. It was formed right after the Revolution concluded, right? The city of Cincinnati is named for him. And so he self-fashioned himself as Cincinnatus, this person who gives up power at every opportunity and refuses to seek power for his own benefit. So that's our model of the heroic leader, the one who we really want, the one who doesn't want power. And in fact, in early American political discourse, you didn't politic, you didn't run for office, because doing so showed that you were unqualified for office. It meant that you were ambitious, and ambition was the worst quality. And so Donald Trump, he's an ambitious man.
Right.
And he's absolutely campaigning on this idea of, like, I want it because I'm going to be great, and I am great because I want it. And he has the ambition to make America great again. And so he is absolutely running on this kind of, as I frame it in this article, American exceptionalism, that links him to the greatness of the nation in a way that seems like hubris and certainly would have rang very strangely to an 18th century or 19th century American ear.
Why do people buy that? He said so many things that you just want to turn him off. And I guess a few people do, but a lot aren't. He just finds these very simple phrases. He calls detractors dummies, or other candidates as, you know, they're just weak. They're weak. They're weak. They're boring. Just make these blanket statements that don't go beyond that, and they seem incredibly simplistic. Is he just sort of talking off the top of his head, or is this a carefully crafted rhetorical technique?
I think probably a little bit of both. He is very proud of the fact that he doesn't use a teleprompter, but I think the effect of that means that he is just talking off the top of his head. I think that it's extemporaneous. I think he has some notes with him and some bullet points, and every now and then he'll quote, you know, a poll or something. But primarily, I think it is extemporaneous. But yeah, so it is simplistic. It's very easy to call somebody a name instead of addressing their argument. And he was very successful in doing this with Jeb Bush and with Carly Fiorina and others, right? So you're boring, you're low energy, you have an ugly face.
Right. Right.
I don't have to address your points because, well, who would want you to be president anyway? You're boring.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, of course, he's not. So he definitely divides the world in sort of, you know, black and white stark terms. You are a winner or you are a loser. And so he's got himself in the winning side. And mm-hmm. all of his opponents are losers.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back.
Yeah, it's a very...
I'm sorry.
But, yeah, I was just going to say, absolutely, you're right. It's a simplistic strategy.
So he said several things that make you just absolutely wince. I mean, he said a lot of things. What he said about John McCain, this comment that he made recently when he talked about something bad is happening. He was talking to New Hampshire voters last week, I believe, or the week before. Something bad is happening. Something really dangerous is going on, playing to all our fears. And then he said, he talked about this link between the shootings in San Bernardino and President Obama's failure to say radical Islamic terrorism. Then this incredible statement, there is something going on with him, referring to Obama, that we don't know about. What in the world was that?
I don't know. But I can tell you that it matches a way of arguing that we have seen in the past, right? That sort of idea of a known unknown, you know, that there are things out there. It's this climate of fear, right, and paranoia. There are things out there that we don't know about. But we know that there's something wrong. We know that there's something going on. And it's similar, I think, to McCarthyism, right? That we know that there are enemies within. They have infiltrated the government.
Mm-hmm.
I have a list.
mm-hmm.
Right.
And one of them may be the president.
And one of them may be the president. And he's gone after the president before. So if you remember, he was... or at least he claims the success of being able to demand Obama's long-form birth certificate.
Right, yeah, and that went on forever, too, forever and forever.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the recent statement about Muslims, which makes two things you say front and center here, American exceptionalism and Muslims' hatred for America, defining Muslims in terms as people who believe only in jihad, filled with hatred, no respect for human life, so they become not human, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The statement is just a short little thing that he posted on his website, and it draws from research from an organization that the Southern Poverty Law Center has deemed, you know, a think tank that's designed to rid the nation of Muslims. So they've put out a poll, and in the poll itself, the data show that while 25% of the American Muslim population who they sampled agreed that violence against Americans here in the United States can be justified as part of the global jihad, 64% disagreed with that statement. And earlier in the poll, it asks the American Muslims who responded to the poll what jihad is. And a good number of them said that it's a personal thing about being more godly. So it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with violence, particularly against the United States. And so the way that he framed it in his article makes it sound like, you know, there's just, again, this crazy population that is within us, that's within the nation. And so the two things about American exceptionalism and framing Muslims work together, right? So, again, Donald Trump is all about winning. There are winners and losers. America should be a winning nation, but right now it's not. He can make America great again, right? So there's that part of American exceptionalism. Then he argues that Muslims don't understand American exceptionalism, that somehow they are immune to, you know, this knowledge or this beautiful understanding, which he says he can't understand why anybody wouldn't understand that. and so what he's able to do in that sentence, and I sort of... kind of key in on the fact that he uses reification, where you treat people as objects and objects as people. He treats the United States as a person, right? He calls it a victim, which is something that would, of course, be the character of a person. And he refers to Muslims as a that, as an object. And so he reverses what we would think of as who we ought to care about, right? So for him, we should care about the nation and not the Muslim population.
Hmm. When you write that political observers have found parallels between him and figures like George Wallace, Joseph McCarthy, Father Coughlin, even Hitler, do you include yourself among those people who see him that way?
Well, I definitely see some parallels in the techniques that he uses. You know, I haven't had the opportunity to study him over a long period of time, and we certainly don't know what his intentions are or what the effect of a Trump presidency would be. But if you look at Joe McCarthy, that idea that there are enemies within, that's very similar. Mm-hmm. If you look at Father Coughlin's rhetoric, he was able to take advantage of new media in, I think, a way that's very similar to Donald Trump. And so for Father Coughlin, it was radio. He became very powerful through using radio, whereas Donald Trump uses social media expertly. If you look at George Wallace, he used fear and resentment in order to coalesce a group of people behind his candidacy and in the way that I think Donald Trump does. So I think that there's some real similarities.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. Many of them are coming in right now. We're talking about the rhetorical brilliance of Trump the Demagogue, written by our guest this hour, Jennifer Mercia, Associate Professor of Communication and Director of the Aggie Agora, Texas A&M University. She has written a very interesting piece on him, and, you know, as he becomes more and more outlandish, he becomes more and more dangerous, actually, with some of the rhetoric that he has been espousing. And yet, he remains nationally way ahead in the polls for those who consider themselves Republicans or likely Republican voters. One poll, I'm not sure how accurate any of these are, but one poll recently said that he's reached the over 40%, although other polls are showing that in Iowa he's been losing ground, perhaps on the basis of his anti-Muslim statements or people are growing tired of him, but there's still a lot of support for this man, so we're trying to figure out why. And our guest has been studying his presidential appeal, his techniques that he uses when he speaks to create support and to create fear. She is the author of Founding Fictions, the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. She's written a number of essays, and she is particularly concerned about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to your phone calls. 800-486-8655. Our number, Robert in Caledonia. Hi.
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 I'm a truck driver. I travel all around the United States. And what Donald Trump is saying is wrong with the country is what's wrong with the country. You know? There's no jobs in any of the inner cities. You know? People don't have anything to do. Crime is up. The politicians that just keep getting elected don't seem to do anything about it. These poll numbers, these are the real people of America trying to tell America what America needs, you know?
But what is it? What does he offer that America needs, Robert?
Well, there's no jobs. You know, I live in Caledonia, right by Oak Creek and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Kids coming out of high school there can't get a job. You go in every big company, it's nothing but Latinos working for nothing. They're being taken advantage of, and kids in this country can't get a job. And this is all over the United States. Wherever you go, you walk in a place, it takes you 10 minutes to find anybody that can speak English to get your load taken off or get a load put on your truck, you know? There's laws that say they can't hire them, but they're not enforced, so they hire them.
Mm-hmm. Do you see Donald Trump as a presidential man?
If he does what he says he's going to do, you know? What it is he's different. That, and it's almost like there's hope. coming or something, you know? My family's been Democratic as far back as I can remember, you know? They're going to spin around in their graves if I vote for the guy, but I might vote for the guy.
Professor Mechia.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, Robert, I understand what you're saying. I grew up in the Detroit suburbs. My whole family worked in the auto industry. My dad did till he retired. You know, my grandfather, all my cousins still do. And I know what it's like, you know, when industry pulled out of this country, it really left a lot of people who would have had fantastic middle-class jobs, and it left them with nothing to do. I think that if we're looking, I mean, and I don't know what Donald Trump's economic plan really is, but I don't think that it's blaming people that's going to help us to solve this problem, right? And I also think that if we looked at Donald Trump's record with his own workers, that we might find that he benefited from the global economy as much as any of these other corporations that have pulled out of America. So I don't know that he's really the answer, but I definitely understand that we have a problem.
And he has, if you're going to examine somebody, you have to examine his record in the casinos in New Jersey, too, where his bankruptcy cost a lot of people their jobs. There are a lot of people who used to work for him who are really mad. Well, it's interesting that Robert, you know, so what is it then? Because when I heard him speak, I know that Senator Sanders is also speaking to the same kinds of concerns about what's happened, who's getting the money, the inequality in this country, the jobs that have left. Why would people go to Donald Trump? Is it because he's this TV guy rather than Bernie Sanders? Professor, what do you think?
Oh, I think that's a great question. I wish, I don't know if Robert's still there. I mean, I think that Bernie Sanders is really popular with young people, surprisingly so, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think for very similar reasons. I don't know why you would prefer one over the other. I heard in Robert's complaint that he identified with some of the issues about immigration that Donald Trump brings up. I don't think that Bernie Sanders talks that way about the immigrant population in this country. So I don't know. I think there might be some nativism that is enforced, and that might explain the difference.
Mm. Thank you, Robert, very much for your call. Steve in Madison, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. my first question was simply whether our only real objection to Donald Trump is that he's not subtle. We want him to be more subtle. Less direct in his comments, and that most of the other Republican candidates hold his same viewpoints, even though they do not express them so directly. And the second question I thought of while I was holding here was whether the professor's criticisms extend equally to what we'll call the right-wing talk show hosts who earn multi-million-dollar salaries by haranguing on these same topics as Donald Trump does, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Those are great questions. So would I like him to be more subtle about it? I think that we are definitely used to hearing politicians use maybe politician speak. I don't know what you want to call it. But we're definitely used to them not being so direct in their criticisms. And I absolutely think that that is part of Donald Trump's appeal to the people who are motivated to vote for him, is that they really like that he's plain-spoken, that he says what he thinks, right? And you seem to actually know what he's thinking, whereas other politicians, you're not sure. I think maybe I don't like what he thinks. So part of my criticism is, you know, that he uses these rhetorical techniques that are sort of mean and mean-spirited. But then also, you know, I would like a politician who wasn't quite so angry at immigrants and other things like that. And then your second question about right-wing talk shows, I have to admit that I haven't studied them as carefully as I have studied Donald Trump's rhetoric recently. But, I mean, I think that they're all a part of the same political discourse, right? So that you're definitely seeing similarities between those talk shows and what Donald Trump is able to do on the stump.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Sunny on Facebook says, every minute spent talking about him is a minute less discussing some of the very real challenges facing the country and world. It's quite depressing, really.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, to be honest, listening to you introduce me, I'm very appreciative of the fact that you mentioned that some of my work is on American citizenship and some of my work is on the American presidency. I didn't ever get invited to talk on any radio shows when I was just writing about citizens, which to me is a real problem, right? Mm-hmm. And even just when I was writing about Barack Obama, as popular as he was, I wasn't invited to be on a radio program like this. So there's absolutely something about Donald Trump that fascinates people, and we certainly are giving him a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. And he does get, I'm not sure why, an inordinate amount of media time. It's amazing to me on cable shows, even those who don't like Donald Trump very much, one of his speeches happens and they cut out of whatever they're talking about and cover Donald Trump endlessly. Why?
Yeah, I think that's the thing about polarizing political figures. You sort of, it's like a car wreck, you know, you look and you think, oh, I hope no one I love is in there, right? You know, I wonder if I can help. He's sort of like that. You want to, oh no, is someone going to get yelled at or what is he going to say? Or, you know, there's this fascination with the unpredictability of him.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander next. Hello, Rich.
Thanks. I was going to ask about the audience for Donald Trump, but before I do that, I just want to say I was really moved by Robert's call. It kind of dovetails with my question. I wanted to ask your guest whether or not in her analysis of any interviews with Trump supporters that she saw any evidence of a personality type, because I told your screener, KP, that I've met Donald Trump, not because I've met Donald Trump, but I think every kid that's been in a schoolyard ever has met somebody like Donald Trump, who talks tough and says, I'm the biggest, baddest, smartest, whatever, you know, I can whip your... you're a loser, I'm a winner, that kind of thing. And I think when frustration builds in a country to a certain level, this has great, great appeal. And I actually think people who are, I'm one of the ones who laughs at him, but I think he's electable. I think if we are not careful in terms of our electoral college politics, we could actually get a, quote, leader like Donald Trump in the White House. And he's not the only Republican who's a Donald Trump, by the way. So,
do you think that's possible, Professor Murcia?
That he's electable?
Yes.
I think it's really difficult to know until people start voting. All the analysis that I've seen of polls, and he's very pleased to tell you that he's winning all the polls, but all the analysis that I've seen of polls says you can't really trust him yet, and we don't really know. So I don't know. I mean, I've seen polls that show him with matchups against Hillary or with Bernie Sanders, and I've seen it go both ways on those as well. I'm not sure if he's electable, just thinking pragmatically. Mm-hmm. But going back to what Rich said about Robert's comments and the way that they touched him, I agree. And the question that Rich asked about the audience for Donald Trump, I think, is a really good one. I think it's a similar audience for Bernie Sanders. I think there was a similar audience for Occupy Wall Street. There is a good chunk of the American population that feels left out and left behind, that feels forgotten. And I think that Donald Trump is able to engage that audience in a way that they haven't been engaged in the past, or at least in recent memory. And I think that he is able to, like Robert said, give them hope again, and sort of turn them against a common enemy, which is the part that, you know, makes a lot of people uncomfortable,
right.
But is a way of addressing real concerns that people have, and those are legitimate concerns.
But isn't it interesting that you can address the real concerns and give up your humanity?
Yeah. It is really interesting, and I think that there's a really nice distinction to be made between a campaign like Bernie Sanders and a campaign like Donald Trump's, where they're making some of the same arguments, not all of them. But, you know, Bernie Sanders refuses, and there's some people who say that he's waffled on this lately, but he refuses to go negative, right? And so there was that famous moment in the debate where they said, you know, what do you think about Hillary Clinton's emails? And he said, I'm tired of talking about this, right? You know, and so I think that there is a way to preserve your humanity, which I think is the question you're asking, right? But also to try to address some of these concerns that people really have, and they're legitimate concerns.
Rich, thanks for your call. Jean in Chippewa County. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Kathleen.
Sure.
I really love your show.
Thanks.
One of the things that I have really been thinking a lot about lately is I think as a nation we've collectively forgotten how to do critical thinking, which is I think why like Robert is the one who got me to call in. When you just hear things that political pundits or political politicians say, and you take it at face value, and people aren't assessing what's being told them, people aren't doing research. You know, our unemployment rate is down. It's as low as it's been in Wisconsin. Interest rates are about to go up because they feel we have economically, we're starting to stabilize. You know, things are not in the toilet like Donald Trump would like us to say, but people just take everything at face value, and we aren't thinking anymore. We aren't using our critical thinking skills, and it has really frustrated me. In fact, I think it would be a great program on your show in the future to remind us that we need to be critical thinkers, that we shouldn't just take what we're told and believe it without doing the research and assessing and making really good decisions for ourselves and for the country. And I think that's why people are flocking to Donald Trump or flocking to people that just spout out, you know, spins or little one-liners, and you take it and you believe it. And I wish we had more critical thinkers. I work with social workers. They still know how to do critical thinking. So I think it's something that is really damaging to all of us. Mm.
Thank you, Jean. You make a good point. Professor Murcia, I'm sure you would
agree
we need to think critically.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things, so I'm in the College of Liberal Arts here at Texas A&M, and it's one of the things that we absolutely stress in all of our courses is critical thinking. And you know, they say, I'm not sure, but they say that's what employers want, right? They want people who are able to apply critical thinking to new information, and that those are the people who end up getting promoted once they get hired and things like that. And in terms of citizenship, I really love what Jean said. You mentioned that I'm the director of the Aggie Agora, and it's a citizen engagement center in our college. And we run what we call Engage Citizenship Workshops. And they're weekly workshops. The topic rotates. And we do fact-check workshops where we show people, you know, some recent controversies in politics and how they were fact-checked to be resolved. And then we also give them fact-checking skills. You know, so tips for how to find out the real information yourself. We look at political advertising. We have an ad watch workshop. We have difficult dialogues where we bring people together to talk about things that are hard to talk about in politics. And then we also have a campaign finance workshop. And all of those are designed to help promote critical thinking and also to bring people into the political process as informed and critical receivers of political information. So it's something that we're really excited about here in our college and at our university.
It's a good program. Thanks, Jean, so much for your call. Kenneth in Shell Lake. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Kenneth.
I just think Donald Trump is the face of angry America. But he's no different than any other politician. I mean, a perfect example of his being the same as all politicians is he went through Iowa and he said he thought ethanol was a good idea just to get votes there. Well, ethanol is the worst idea that ever happened. I think we need all these politicians, and I haven't heard a single one of them say it, to look in the camera during the debates and say what Kennedy said. Ask not what your country can do for you. But they just give promises, and so the American people use that as an excuse.
What about the rhetoric that he's been using, Kenneth? Do you see him, this anti-Muslim rhetoric, these comments about the president, the comments about how weak everybody else is, do you see those and the resulting actions that people in his rallies now, if you're protesting, you're beaten by other people on the ground and yelled Heil Hitler, and I mean, all this really nasty things that are happening. The KKK is recruiting volunteers to fight the spread of Islam. There have been all kinds of Islamic attacks on Muslims in this country since he made those statements. Isn't that something different than what all the other candidates are saying or not?
Yeah, it is, but it's just history repeating itself. He's trying to get votes, and him saying that is different than everybody else. But boy, it sure is striking a chord in this country, isn't it?
But
every American ought to stop and think about that.
Well, what chord is it striking, Kenneth, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of people that distrust anybody that looks different than them. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, some Muslims get on an airliner and everybody wants to get off. Well, you can't ignore the way the American people feel. And he's just whipping it up to get elected.
Thanks, Kenneth, for the call. Do you want to respond to his call, Professor?
Oh, you know, and I guess the thing that I would say is that he's right about distrust, and it's interesting that Americans right now distrust every branch of government. They have no faith in the direction of the country, in the news media, you know, elected officials. And so I think, perhaps, that Donald Trump and the attraction of Donald Trump is that it's sort of, he represents this crisis in America, this crisis of confidence and faith in the nation, and perhaps even a constitutional crisis. And so that's one of the things that I'm really looking for in terms of how this plays out is, you know, sort of the big picture of what does it mean that so many people are attracted to him and his candidacy.
Well, and you write in your piece, one fear of having demagogues actually attain real power is that they will disregard the law or the Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in my my examination of the history of demagoguery in this country, I've looked at the conditions under which a person is charged as a demagogue. You know, so why is it that we call somebody like Eugene Debs a demagogue? And, you know, what does it mean when he says, that's right, I am a demagogue. And by the way, so was Thomas Jefferson. And so was every great leader who ever made any change in this country. Right. So there's a way in which that term is, you know, constituted that I think is very interesting. And so in looking at how we have accused people of demagoguery over the years, it's almost always that they are an unaccountable slash ambitious leader, right? That our fear is that we're going to put someone into power who we cannot control through the regular mechanisms of controlling presidents or, you know, whatever it is. And the thing about Donald Trump that fascinates me, one of the things, is that he has absolutely run as an uncontrollable leader.
Right.
He says, I am not going to listen to the party leadership. I am not going to listen to the party. I am not going to listen to the news media. I am not going to listen to truth. I am not going to listen to, I don't know, political correctness, right? He says, you know, what Robert said, I'm going to speak the truth. I'm going to say what I think. And no one's going to control me, which is exactly the thing that we don't want in a political leader.
Right. Oh,
right? Because that means that when he's elected, we won't be able to control him through the Constitution or any of the other mechanisms that we would think we would control him. I mean, and he's a rich guy, right? Like, this is someone who could conceivably pay off the military, right? I mean, I don't mean to get into conspiracy theories, but this is the logic of the 18th century, was that you didn't want someone who could buy the military and become dictator. This is someone that you could see doing something like that. So, it's interesting to think about the way that the Constitution can become disfigured and how putting a person in control of that government could lead into all kinds of implications.
Yeah. Thanks, Kenneth, for your call. More calls in a moment. We're talking about Donald Trump this hour of the program, his rhetorical skills. Our guest wrote an interesting piece, The Rhetorical Brilliance of Trump the Demagogue. And she is joining us this hour, Professor Jennifer Murcia, She's at Texas A&M University. She's a historian of American political discourse. Back to your phone calls, and we have one line open right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, too, where we'd like to read your comments, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go to Glenn in Blue Mounds. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thought I had is that maybe Trump will get about halfway through, and then I'll go, I really don't want any part of this. I just wanted to see how many blind sheep there were and how many fools there were. And then I'll just walk away because he can afford to do that, and he just wants to be, the be-all and end-all, and just wanted to see how many fools there were that would follow him. You know?
He just wanted to sell a bunch of hats.
Yeah, exactly. I could see him doing that. Who knows with this guy? He could, don't you think? But I don't know, once you get in the position where you got all these people adoring you and you're number one in the polls, you probably get even more full of yourself, don't you? Or he could.
Yeah, I would think so.
Do you think there's a chance he's going to walk away from all of it, Professor Mercia?
I have thought that he will stay in the race for as long as he's having fun being in the race. I've heard him say on multiple occasions recently, in fact, that he's not going to drop out, that he's not ever going to drop out, kind of like Churchill, never going to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
I think he could. I mean, I've seen some things that say, you know, he's really in the tank for Hillary Clinton, and he's just running to distract the nation, all kinds of stuff. Maybe that was an Onion article, I'm not sure. But, it could all just be a big farce.
Yeah.
He's an entertainer. It could all be theater.
Mm. Thank you, Glenn. Entertaining thought that was. Judith in Wausau. Hi, Judith.
Hi. Thank you for taking
my
call. I think there's one way in which Donald Trump distinguishes himself from almost everybody else out there without ever having to say it. As you commented, he keeps saying, you know, I'm smart, I'm smart, I'm smart. I'm a doer. I made all this money. You know, I run this business. I do all these things, and I will do things. And it makes me think of Richard Hofstadter's so aptly titled book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life.
Mm.
I think there are many people who see Obama as a cool intellectual,
mm-hmm.
and so he distinguishes himself that way. When you listen to Hillary Clinton talk, she's obviously very knowledgeable and very intelligent. And she is concerned, I think, to convey herself in that way. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is somebody who's hot-headed, who appears to lose control of his emotions and his opinions at certain points, to a certain extent, for the camera, I think, but nonetheless, that's how it appears. And he doesn't get the reaction from the press or his supporters that Howard Dean got when he supposedly lost control in that one famous instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that without saying it, and you wonder how conscious this is, that Donald Trump is appealing to that rather traditional anti-intellectual bent in American culture. I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Good comments. Professor?
Oh, absolutely. Everyone should read that book, too, Richard Hofstadter's Anti-Intellectualism. He's got another one about the paranoid style. Great books. And I really like Judith's comment comparing Trump to Barack Obama and the way that he's perceived as too cool and too intellectual by some. And I think that that's a really nice comparison to draw between Trump and Obama. I think Trump is really running as the anti-Obama.
Mm. His speeches, let's talk about this a little bit, often peppered with ad baculum arguments. We need to talk about what those are. When people come after me, they go down the tubes. And you also reference others who have used these devices in a somewhat, you know, scary, threatening way.
Yeah, there's a couple of great examples that I put in that piece. So one is George Wallace. He says, if any demonstrator ever lays down in front of my car, it'll be the last car he ever lays down in front of.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's definitely ad baculum. Right, so there are appeals to force or to threats or physical violence.
In fact, the news yesterday was that he and Ted Cruz might be in some kind of fight, right? And Ted Cruz backed down and said, "Oh, the media wants us to be mad at each other, but I think Donald Trump is great, ha ha." And you know, Donald Trump, you know, spit something back about him, says, "Oh, you know, I'm going to get him." So there's definitely a lot of that bully behavior, a lot of intimidation. He's got this army of people on Twitter. You know, you don't want to mess with that group.
Right.
You know, they're kind of scary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he definitely uses ad baculum. I think that, you know, his appeals to the wisdom of the crowd, the ad populum arguments are also really prevalent and interesting. I notice in his campaign events that he tells the camera to pan the crowd. Show them the crowd. They always say that nobody's here and there's such a big crowd. Show the crowd. You know, so he really wants people to see how many people have turned up for him. And he's always talking about the polls or, you know, how great of a show he had and how many people watched it. So there's this real appeal to, like, the wisdom of the people. And that's not always bad. But if that's your only argument for why you should be president, you know, maybe there's some other arguments that could be made that have more substance. And then one of my other favorite things that he does is paralipses. We talked before about the uncontrollable leader. So paralipses is where you say the thing that you say you're not going to say, and then you distance yourself from it. You know, I would never say that. And it's a great way to say something or raise an issue without being held accountable for it, right? And so he says in New Hampshire, he's talking about his competitors. He says, "But all of the other candidates are weak, and they're just weak. And I think that they're weak generally, if you want to know the truth. But I don't want to say that because I don't want to, I don't want to have any controversies. No controversies. Is that okay? So I refuse to say that they are weak generally."
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It makes me laugh every time I read it.
Let's go to Nick in Brilliant. We're getting short on time. Hi, Nick.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I called back like 20 minutes ago when we were talking about something else, but kind of wanted to emphasize it is that there's a lot of other things that are appealing about Donald Trump than just this hate mongering, which I do see in real life. I mean, people are, you know, like it says on, we don't live in a liberal, or, you know, the world isn't a liberal arts college. I mean, there's people out there who are full of all kinds of nastiness. And, but I wanted to say that what he appeals to me for is not that hatefulness, but his anti-establishment comments, like when he says that he's not going to be bought off from lobbyists because, you know, he has the money to do it himself and he doesn't have to pander to all these people like Hillary Clinton, who he paid to go to his wedding and stuff like this. And he doesn't have that much money and to be buying off the military, though. I don't know how your professor thinks that could work. He's cost like $1 million a day to run a campaign, and he's got his own private jet. I read a whole article in Rolling Stone about it. But yeah, those things though about his anti-establishment, they really scare, really, really scare. And that's what your professor said. We're afraid of having somebody who can actually do something. Which, how can you don't even? It's kind of like you really don't have that much faith in the Constitution and our government. I mean, look how they've binded Obama. For how many years he couldn't do anything. I mean, you don't think our president doesn't have that much power. I mean, to have that little faith in the U.S. government, I mean...
Mm-hmm. Professor?
Yeah, I'm sure he actually can't buy the military, even though he says he has all the money. You know, so do I have faith in the Constitution? I do, to be honest. I originally had written this in the piece, and it got cut out because I wrote too long. But in the end, I sort of considered this thing, you know, can he really be a demagogue? And in the end, what I said is, no, he's going to be beholden to the Constitution in the same way that every other, you know, quote, loser president before him was. So I don't think that he actually could fulfill all the promises that he's making, because I don't think that he could be the unaccountable leader. I think that constitutional mechanisms would go into effect. I think that if he really did try to do some of the things that he says, I think that he probably would be impeached.
Hmm. Thank you, Nick, very much for the call. Just very briefly, are you going to watch tonight or have you had it?
Oh, no, I'll be watching.
You'll be watching.
Definitely.
Yeah, it
definitely.
There will be something. You know, maybe that's why we're watching. It's becoming a reality show. Who's going to say what to who, and how nasty is it going to get, and on and on and on. What a presidential campaign this one is. Thank you, Professor, so much for being with us.
Oh, it was
my
pleasure.
Very interesting. Our thanks to Professor Jennifer Merchia, and she is at Texas A&M University. She's a historian of American political discourse, especially about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. And she wrote a piece. Well, actually, the New York Times had this piece that got a lot of attention on December 5, 95,000 words, many of them ominous, from Donald Trump's tongue. And they quoted Professor Merchia because she has spent a lot of time analyzing what Donald Trump has said and has written about it in a piece that caught our attention as well, The Rhetorical Brilliance of Trump, the Demagogue. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production. Thanks to you for your calls. Open line coming up. Please give us your program suggestions. We haven't done it in so long, and it should be fun.